Hey, Genesis 1, last week we started a new series on work. Yeah, here's the plan for tonight. I want to look at the exact same passages as last week and go deeper. One of the things I love about the Bible is there are layers, meaning you can keep digging and digging and digging deeper and deeper and keep finding more and more. And that's the way the Bible works. And my goal with the next few minutes is to unearth a few things in the text that have been buried for way too long. That said, Genesis 1, let's start off in 26. Here we go. Then God said, "Let us make mankind," or human, "in our," what? "Image. In our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own, what? Image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. What does that mean? To be made in God's image or likeness? In the ancient Near East, kings would set up images, or in today's language, statues, in the far reaches of the kingdom. And the images were made in the likeness of the king, meaning these statues looked like the king. But more than that, the images were used by the local governors who were co-ruling with the king, used by the local governors to get the king's will or laws done in the far reaches of the kingdom as it is in the capital. Humans are God's image bearers, or God's representatives over the earth. There are two pieces to that reality. We reflect and we rule. Yes, we reflect, meaning we mirror back to God. We bear central aspects of what God is like in our DNA. God is a person. God is a worker. God is a creative. You are a person. You are a worker. You are a creative. But it's more than that. We are also called to rule. God says, "Let us make mankind in our own image, in our own likeness, so that they may," what? Yes, rule over the earth. Now, remember, rule in Hebrew is king language. It can be translated to rule or to reign or to have dominion. One Hebrew scholar I found translates the word rule, and I quote, as to actively partner with God in taking the world somewhere. I love that. What does that mean? That means from the beginning of the story, God has been looking for partners. And I'm intentional with the language of partners. The imagery in Genesis 1 and 2 is not of puppets on a string and God's up in the heavens playing, but of partners or image bearers or representatives, the word used in theology is co-regents or co-rulers, ruling with God over the earth. That's how God works. God could have chosen to make humans from the dust like he did with Adam, but instead he chose to work through who? You're like, "Not me, I'm single." Well, okay. Humans, right? Through marriage and sexuality and family. God could have chosen to make bread fall from the sky like he did in the Exodus, but instead he chose to work through who? Yeah, new seasons, right? Through farmers and traders and merchants and agriculture and technology. Why? Because God is looking for partners. Let's keep reading. 28 says, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill," all the single people are like, "I'm trying, give me a date," right? "Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over every living creature that moves on the ground." In theology, verse 28 is called the cultural mandate or the creation mandate. And put simply, it's human's first job description. God creates Adam, or human, and says, "Okay, you are made in God's image to rule over the earth. Here's your job. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue, rule," or put in today's language, create culture. The cultural mandate breaks down into two parts. The first part is be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, which means make something of the social world. Make something out of people. And it means more than make babies. It's that. Get married, have sex, make babies, start families. But it's also create schools and churches and social structures and institutions and governments and laws and languages and nations and ethnic cultures and tribes. Create, make stuff out of people. Make something out of the social world. The second part is subdue and rule, and means harness the natural world. Plant crops, build houses, design software, make lattes and mochas, create and compose music, make art out of the raw materials in the world, plan cities, build homes and bridges, pave roads, make stuff out of the world. Humans' job is to take the world somewhere. Now, the case study is Genesis 2. Turn the page. Next chapter, Genesis 2, look down at 8. Now, the Lord God had planted a garden in the east, and the garden is a literal garden, but it's also a metaphor for creation as a whole and work in general. Planted a garden in the east, in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food, meaning beauty and aesthetic and design are important to God, and functionality, good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And now look at 10, a river watering the garden flowed from Eden. From there, it was separated into four headwaters. The name of the first is the Pishon. It winds through the entire land of Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. Aromatic resin and onks are also there, in case you're interested. The name of the second river is the Gihon. It winds through the entire land of Cush. The name of the third river is the Tigris. It runs along the east side of Ashur. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Now, how many of you reading that are like, I don't care? Right? One of the paragraphs in the Bible, what you're reading, and you're like, why is that there? Like four headwaters and the gold of that land is good. Okay, thank you. And onks and aromatic, what is aromatic resin, right? And you're reading it, why is that there? Actually, it's really important in the text. The author is saying, Eden is made up of raw materials. Eden is made up of trees and rivers. Now keep in mind, we live in the modern world disconnected from the environment. In the ancient Near East, trees and rivers are life. Think of oxygen, right? I mean, trees are where you get wood and fire and sources of energy and food and sustenance. Rivers, all ancient civilizations were on rivers because agriculture was connected to rivers and commerce and trade and economy and civilization and villages and learning and languages. All of that happens on rivers in the ancient Near East. Eden is trees and rivers and food and fruit and vegetables and gold and metals and minerals under the ground. Eden is pure potentiality. And God says, look at 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to what? Work it and take care of it. Here's one definition of work from Tim Keller, who's one of my favorite teachers. He says, work is rearranging the raw materials of a particular domain to draw out its potential for the flourishing of who? Everyone. Not me, but everyone. Work is serving others. Rearranging the raw materials of a particular domain to draw out its potential for the flourishing of everyone. Where does he get that? He gets that from Genesis 2. In fact, the word work, God put Adam in the garden to work it, is abad in Hebrew, and it can be translated to cultivate or to develop or to draw out its potential. Here is what you have to understand. Next slide. The garden was dynamic, not static. Or put another way, the creation was a project, not a product. Not all neat and tiny, tidy with a bow, finish. No, the creation was a project in motion, meaning the garden was designed to go somewhere. When you think about the Garden of Eden, don't think of a public park with paths and ponds and lawns, and God says, Adam, okay, here is a lawnmower and clippers. Go keep the garden nice. Which is kind of the imagery in a bunch of people's minds. Am I right? Think instead of a wild, untamed wilderness, hundreds of thousands of geographic square miles, teeming with raw beauty and materials and energy and violence and potential. And God says, okay, Adam, it's wild, no civilization. Go make a world. Go make roads and build bridges and create cities and homes and culture and technology and science and medicine, art and beauty and food and cuisine. Go make something with the world. That is why when you get to the end of the story of the Bible, Revelation 21 and 22, last two chapters, and the author, John, talks about God's future for the earth. He talks about the day when Jesus returns, not to take everybody away from earth to heaven, that is flat out unbiblical theology, but to take heaven crashing into earth, to put the world to rights, resurrection, humans come back from the dead, the cosmos comes back from the dead, God makes the world new. We live here in a city called the New Jerusalem. Now, Revelation 21 and 22, when John writes about the New Jerusalem, he writes in Eden language. Blatant, no holes barred. He is clearly alluding back to the Genesis story. He talks about a tree of life right in the middle of the city. He talks about a river that flows right through the middle of the city. He says there's no more curse. He's saying the New Jerusalem is Eden all over again. But it's not. Eden was a garden. The New Jerusalem is a garden-like city. Why is that? I mean, if Jesus comes to put the world back together again, if Jesus comes to fix the problem, why doesn't the story end in a garden? Why doesn't the story end with Genesis 2 all over again? Why? Because, next slide, the garden was never supposed to stay a garden. The garden was always supposed to become a garden-like city. Take that. Now, in between Genesis 1 and 2, and Revelation 21 and 22, there's a whole bunch of Bible. Am I right? What happens in Genesis 3? Yeah, in theology, it's called the fall. In layman's term, Adam screws up. Thank you very much, right? If you were to take sin out of the story of the Bible, you would be left with a pamphlet. Right? Genesis 1 and 2, and Revelation 21 and 22. But sin screws up the human story. Now, in Genesis 3 and past, we have a serious problem because the world is wild and needs taming. The world is chaotic and needs order. The world needs ruling, and whose job is it to rule over the earth? Yeah, human's job, my job, your job, but human is broken. Human is out of sync with God. In certain cases, human is flat out at war with God. And now instead of doing what the scriptures clearly teach, in spite of hyper-conservative modern Republicans, the scriptures clearly teach human's job is to work the earth and take care of the earth. Genesis chapter 2:15, one of the first things we learn. But in spite of that, now human is abusing the earth. And the root issue is not oil. The root issue is human. We are broken and in need of saving, which is why Jesus comes. Jesus comes to put human back right with God. Jesus does what Adam was supposed to do. Jesus rules. He's called the Messiah or the King of the world or the ruler. The gospel in one sentence is, Jesus is what? Lord. Jesus' message is the inbreaking of God's kingdom, God's rule and reign over the earth in and through a human called Jesus. Jesus is putting the world back together again, one human at a time. Now, turn over to Matthew 28 really fast. Turn to the right in your Bibles to Matthew 28, and let's read the last words of Jesus. Last words of Jesus, Matthew 28, and last words, I think, tell a story. And in Matthew 28, if you look at verse 16, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him. Some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, and I quote, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." which is how you say Jesus is Lord in the first person. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. Theologians point out the parallels between the cultural mandate in Genesis 1, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue, and rule, and what is called the Great Commission right here in Matthew 28, go, make disciples of all nations. Or in Mark, Jesus says, go into all the world and preach the, what? Gospel. And theologians argue what Jesus is doing here is rephrasing the original cultural mandate in light of sin and in light of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. Meaning what? Meaning now, as followers of Jesus, we have a dual vocation. Now remember from last week, what does the word vocation mean? Calling, right? We have a dual vocation, meaning we have two callings from God. We have the original one, to create culture, to make something of the world, to go make stuff with your hands, with your mind, with your job, with computers, with your imagination, with family, with whatever, to go make something of the world and create culture. And now we have a secondary vocation and calling that falls on every single man or woman who follows Jesus. To make disciples and preach the gospel and help people come back into contact with the Creator God. And it's a both and. The majority of people want to pick one, am I right? Some people are hyper passionate about work and what they do and work hard and don't have a lazy bone. But when was the last time you shared Jesus with coworkers or customers or people you come in contact with? I don't know. I work hard and figure people will get it, maybe, kind of, sort of. Other people are the opposite. Other people are hyper-passionate about the gospel and coworkers and people on the street and friends and neighbors who don't know Jesus, but you are a lousy employee. I mean, straight up. You know the dude who's like getting paid to manage accounts in the cubicle and instead he's reading his Bible? To clarify, that's not godly, right? If Jesus were there, and he is, he would be saying, get back to work. And he's into the Bible. From what I understand, he like is the author, right? But he's not into people stealing from employers by not working when you are getting paid to work. There's a word for that, stealing. And we all know how Jesus feels about stealing, right? Like both are important to God. I mean, my prayer is that you would live as a missionary everywhere you go. Whether you go to Africa, or we prayed over a couple this morning, going to Cambodia, or whether you go to PSU, or Barista, or Pete's, or the job site, or OHSU, wherever you work, do school, do life, you are a missionary, you are sent by God with the gospel. And my prayer is that you would be the best employees in the city of Portland. I dream of the day when companies come to churches in the city, knock on the door and say, do you have anybody who's out of work? Because followers of Jesus are the best employers we have and best employees we have. I mean, you are the people who show up early, stay late, smile on your face, good attitude. You don't gossip. You don't critique. You are responsible. You get the job done. You don't screw around. When you are at work, you work hard. Seriously, where are all the followers of Jesus? I want to hire somebody, right? You're like, you're an idealist, aren't you? I know, I'm sorry. But I dream of that day when that is the reputation of people who follow Jesus. When people like you and me buy into the dual vocation to create culture and to make disciples. Now, that said, I'm gonna bring up five of my friends who are doing just that. Come on up. And my friends are not public speakers per se, but how about a bit of love for my friends? Come on up. Take a seat, and here's the plan for the next 20 minutes. I want to take all the theology of the last 2 weeks, partnering with God to take the world somewhere, blah, blah, blah. What does that actually mean? And I want to put flesh and blood on it through five of my friends who are doing just that, who are in a vocation. Remember last week, we said a vocation is a calling from God to work that one. Anybody remember? No. Okay. That's not a healthy sign on my teaching. Calling from God to work that one fits you, two helps others, and three glorifies God. And you're looking at five people who are in vocations, who are in callings from God that fit you, your personality, what you enjoy, what you're good at, bad at, help others. Every single one of you are working for shalom in the world and glorifies God. Every single person here is in full-time ministry, but do any of you work at a church?
Nope.
Nonprofit? Nope. You're a mom. That's like the ultimate nonprofit.
No profit.
Any of you pastors? Not that I'm aware of, but everybody here views work as ministry. It's one of the things I love. Christoph, let's start off with you. He is one of my new friends, and gosh, man, I have so much respect for you. You are a scientist.
That's right.
Where do you work?
I work at OHSU right now.
And what do you do? What's your field of study?
I'm a virologist, and in case if you're wondering what that means, is I study these little bugs that make you sick, in particular HIV, is one of my passions. It's a big problem right now.
Yeah, and okay, and he is super humble. I was trying to get him to brag last hour, and like I could not for the life of me. He is brilliant, leading scientist on the vanguard of a vaccine for HIV/AIDS, and you're the closest we have been in 30 years to your lab, your team that you are working with, to a vaccine for HIV/AIDS.
Right.
And doing amazing, amazing work. And it really comes out of your own story. You're fascinating. You're Polish. But you married a woman from Zimbabwe.
Right, and we met Dancing Salsa, by the way.
And you met Salsa down.
Not at a church.
That's awesome.
We did not meet in the library or the church.
Oh my goodness.
Don't go out to the club right now.
Yeah, with the eight, you need to make sure you lay down the rules, right?
To let you know.
Like, salsa dancing, okay. They take salsa dancing all over the place. But you married a woman from Zimbabwe, and I've been to Zimbabwe twice, and it has, when I was there, was the highest, I don't know what it's at now, one of the highest rates of HIV/AIDS in the world. Does that affect what you do, what you are giving your life to?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, there's many fields in science that you can get involved in. I've done a number of things, but HIV is by far the most pressing one and the one that I'm personally affected by. So I've been to Zimbabwe probably four or five times in the last 10 years. You know, we got married there, and my wife's family's there, relatives and friends, and we've seen people get sick, we've seen people die, and she has some cousins that were orphaned, friends that fell ill, aunts and uncles that have died in the past. So it's a big problem.
Yeah.
Between 20-30% is estimated in sub-Saharan Africa are infected with HIV.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could count 1, 2, 3, 4. The fourth person next to you could have it.
Yeah.
And it's a pandemic. It's really the killer of our lifetimes. And it's global. And people have been working on treatments, and fortunately there are some, but there's no vaccine yet. And I've been working on that for 30 years. Not me, but others have.
Because you're what, 25 now?
Yeah. 18.
Yeah.
And I have 3 kids, so
right.
You do the math.
Wow, never mind. I mean, you work with that. And what were you saying last hour? You said that you view yourself as a partner. You were using partnership language.
Yeah, I think, you know, to tie back to your sermon, I think that it's the idea of partnering with God to try to alleviate human suffering. You know, and somebody's sick, you want to help them.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't want to have diseases like HIV ravaging through populations and creating AIDS orphans. And there's a whole generation in Zimbabwe and other countries like that has been wiped out.
Yep. I've been there. It's gone. It's missing. We're adopting from Uganda right now. You walk on the ground, there's a missing generation. It's crazy. And I mean, here's a man, get what's going on here. He looks at Jesus. How does Jesus feel about healing the sick? He's kind of for that, am I right? OSU, whatever, doctor crowd over there somewhere, right? He's really into healing. And at the same time, he looks at his own story and his wife and family and background and leverages what he does for work into the heart of God and what he's passionate about. And he's giving his life to fix one of the leading problems in the world. And you're doing it as a scientist. I mean, there are all sorts of stigmas in the church and the scientific community about both and. What's that like? And we have a bunch of people here who are not yet in a vocation, who are in school, who are thinking, dreaming about the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years of work. What would you say to somebody thinking about a career in science, like, can you have faith in Jesus and have brain cells at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, can't, what, what's the, that's a leading question, but, you know, what's, but seriously, what's the relationship between faith and science for you as a leading scientist and as a follower of Jesus?
Well, you know, the idea is don't check your brain at the door when you come here. You know, being a follower of Christ does not exclude you being an intellectual person.
Right.
And in fact, Jesus said to worship God with your mind also.
Yep.
And I think lots of times we forget about that. And it's just all about emotions and other things like that. But don't forget that God created you with your unique abilities, unique talents. And if you're struggling with some of the aspects, there are tensions and there are unanswered questions. There are very difficult questions. But think about it. Is it worth running away from that just because it's hard?
Yeah.
Or just because, you know, maybe you feel uncomfortable with that? I think it's absolutely worth it. So if you have a bent towards, you know, an intellectual pursuit, whether it's science or something else, go for it. Dream big.
Yep.
And, you know, pursue the passion that God has given you.
What an amazing word. Thank you. Really good stuff. I'm going to swing around 180 degrees to you, Michelle. You are a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah.
And first off, we want to validate your work as a vocation and as a calling from God. And I know, I think of both of you sisters, there's a stigma. It's kind of a lose-lose for sisters, because if you stay home when you have kids, there's a stigma. People look down at you, whatever. And if you don't stay home, like Serena we're going to talk about in a minute, then there's a whole other stigma, you know. And we simply want to affirm both of you and thank God for both of you and what God is doing through your life. And Michelle, I'm a dad, and your husband's over here, and I know it takes just as much brains and bronze to do your job as Christoph's. No offense, buddy, but who said four-year-olds are not more difficult and complex than viruses around the world?
It's
what's your story? I mean, because I know for a bunch of women, it's like you grew up dreaming about being a mom, and for a bunch of other women, it's like, no way, are you kidding me? What was your story? Did you want to be a mom, not want to be a mom, and what's that look like for you?
Yeah, my story would not have been the story that I'm living right now. My story would have been, I was going to be on the mission field. I went to school to have a degree. I wanted to challenge my mind. I wanted to know what broke the Lord's heart, and I wanted to see it firsthand. I didn't want to be naive. And watching my mom was a single mom. She had two of us kids, and she worked two jobs most of her life. And so for me, being a stay-at-home mom was kind of like a cop-out. And now I'm living the separate dream. And so I went to school to, like I said, I went to school at Biola, and I got a degree in intercultural studies. And then I met my husband, and we, he's down there, he's pretty handsome, but he's mine. Anyways, we met in Ecuador, we came back here to Portland, and we both got a job at Luis Palau. And so I oversaw all the national operations of all the festivals for a few years. And I was 8 months pregnant, and I was pretty sure I was still going back to work. And the Lord definitely changed my heart. He brought a very wise woman into my life who said, Michelle, for who you are, your personality, you're all or nothing. And either you totally put yourself into motherhood or you put yourself into your work. And she was right. For some of us, we can compartmentalize and we can handle 5 million things. And I'm handling 5 million things in my home, and I'm thankful for that. And so that's where I'm at right now. And I can tell you, I'm working with raw material. Like, literally, these boys are adorable, and they have, you know, they come out with beautiful skin. They're nasty inside, and they are. I am just praying that, you know, Jay and I together, we have a heart to not raise perfect boys, but to raise God-fearing men who will be change agents for this world. And through them, I can't even tell you how many women I've had in my life come into my room, our house, and even at the park, all over our neighbors, all over the place. Carter doesn't care if his friends are believers, but I care, and I am getting to know those moms. And through our story and doing life together, we're able to share about Jesus, and people want to know.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Notice how she sees mothering through the lens of Genesis 1. Like, when you start saying, my two boys are raw materials, right?
Yeah.
You know you're a woman with a degree with a bit of theology under your belt, right? But she views mothering not as maintenance, right? But is actually raising up and releasing two humans into the kingdom of God and into the world. And you're doing an amazing job. Your boys and your husband is happy with you, right, Jay? And well done. Let's jump over to David. David, you are a Mason, not a Freemason, not in a cult.
Nope.
Mason, as in bricklayer, right? Yep. You work with your hands. Like the difference between your hands and mine is evident, right? You don't get calluses from...
I'm a little bit of a prima donna.
You don't get calluses from these, you know. We have a few pictures of David's work. Here's a house. Yeah. He made like the whole thing. Like he was general contractor and did the majority of the work. Like he made the house. Next slide. Here's a picture of the side. Here's the brick. Next one. Here's David up on the side laying brick. Here's a few other houses. Next slide. Suburban Love right there. Where is that? Like Lake O or something?
Westland.
Yeah, right. Called it. The next slide. Here, watch the next one. Are you serious, right? He made that with these things right here. Like, how crazy is that? Tell the story. Like, how did you become a mason? Like, what's the backstory to working with your hands?
I actually didn't become a mason on purpose. More of an accident, but I feel that God led me there. I went to school to design homes. So everything from junior high on, I did a lot of drafting, a lot of design,
yep.
space planning, and kind of worked homes from the inside function to the outside. So I've always had a passion for design. I've done a fair amount of that, but my profession has always... I always end up with a trowel in my hand,
right,
and a hammer. So, I went to work for my girlfriend's dad just when I was about 19, I think, and because I needed a job, I couldn't find a job in design. So I ended up being his helper, just climbing up a ladder all day with.
And he was a bricklayer.
He was a bricklayer. Yeah.
Yep.
So I would mix mortar, carry bricks for him. And he could see kind of where the relationship was going with myself and his daughter. And he saw the need to give me a career and make sure that I took care of his daughter.
Like, you need a job to get to work.
Yeah, so he very quickly taught me the trade.
Yep.
And I learned a lot from him just to be mechanical and to kind of put the things that I was used to seeing in 2D on paper kind of flipped up into 3D. And so
yep.
all of a sudden I'm working in 3D. And just, it was a huge change for me. So I ended up working for him for about 17 years.
Okay.
And eventually kind of the next step was to start
starting your own business.
Yeah.
Yep.
And did that for a few years. Always still kind of leaning towards, yeah, it's a job. I'm making money, but I want to be doing this other thing.
Right.
And
kind of discontent.
Yeah, just kind of discontent, getting up and going to work and doing my job, but like, always wanting
something else.
The bigger
yeah,
thing.
Like hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a few years ago when the economy took a dive and construction was really slow. And for some reason, I felt like I was the only brick mason working in town. I mean, there were other guys.
But were doing well in spite of the economy.
I had a lot of work. A lot of guys were calling me every day for work. Are you hiring? And, I had a lot of stuff going. And God just revealed himself to me one day at work. And he just basically said, are you kidding me? You know, look what I have given to you. I've given to you a craft. You get to build things with your hands. You get to feed your family. You have a house. You have a car. Your wife has a car. I mean, just all these things.
People you're providing for, right?
People, I was providing work for guys and their families that depended on their paychecks. And just, I could kind of see the order of things and the way that God was blessing
right.
me through that. And I realized that day that God had given me a gift. And it was... It was an awesome gift. I mean, I get to literally stand back at the end of the day and look at something that I built, and it's kind of satisfying. I like it. I'm getting dirty, and I didn't plan on that, and I've got a sore back every night, and I didn't plan on that, but it feels really good to get out and sweat and put a hole in my jeans or whatever, but it's it's rewarding in that fact, but then the most rewarding part about my job now is that every day, probably it doesn't go by, that I'm driving down the road and I'm thanking God for my gift. And I just thank you for the gas in my tank and a job site to go to and a healthy body to be able to do that. And I mean, literally Friday I did that and God just blessed me so much in kind of worshiping him through the gift that he gave me all at the same time.
Oh, and dude,
it's
preach
just,
it.
It's, yeah.
Wait, you mean worshiping God through laying brick? You can do that?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, it's, absolutely.
It's a blast.
Oh
it's
my
blast.
God. And it's a blast. And it can be fun to worship God by working. Yeah. Am I right?
Yeah.
Wow. And I love David's story because for what you said, 17 years, he's discontent, he wrestles, and he finally resigns to the fact, okay, I'm really good at this. And he starts to work. I mean, the Bible, David, as you know, is one of the only books in the history of the world that celebrates manual labor. I mean, it was countercultural in the first century, more so than today. And God celebrates men who make stuff with fingers and hands and arms. Adam was a gardener. Jesus was a carpenter. Paul was a tent maker. And God is really into men and women who make stuff with hands. And you do really well. And I love that you see your work and your worship as one and the same. Absolutely amazing. Let's move over to Serena. You're up next. Serena, absolutely incredible. So happy you and your family are part of the church. She works downtown, her runs a business a few blocks from here, lives right off Burnside, and you are a forensic accountant. How cool does that sound? Yeah, one person knows what that is. All I know is if I said accountant, no offense accountants, but you'd be like, okay, boring. But you put the word forensic in front and whoo, now we're kicking, right? What the heck is a forensic accountant? You own your own business, super successful. What do you do?
Well, a forensic accountant is a combination of accounting, finance, and law. And I investigate allegations of financial harm. So I work on litigation cases where there's some kind of wrongdoing or some allegation that there's been financial harm. And I investigate that. And then I quantify what that harm is so that the parties can settle if they're smart. Or I may go to court and testify about my findings and my opinion of what is the value of the harm and what damages should be. So that's what.
Meaning you catch white collar bad guys.
Yes, that's some of what I do.
Right?
Very
Bernie
famous.
Madoff, yeah, be aware of Serena is coming after you.
There have actually been cases in Portland very similar to the Bernie Madoff case that I've worked on, investment type crimes. People have lost a lot of money.
You you are working for justice in the world.
Yes, and that's one way to look at it.
And you pick up the Old Testament in particular, but the Bible as a whole, it's really easy to learn what God feels about justice. Mm-hmm. And do you enjoy what you do, hate what you do, ambivalent? What's the story?
I've always enjoyed what I do, but I also struggled with discontent for a while. And my husband and I started a ministry about 10 years ago in Rwanda. And
she's bashful. It's Africa New Life. It's one of the largest ministries in Africa. And she does that on the side. Keep going.
Well,
and you're a mom. How many kids?
Yeah, four. Four kids.
Four
yeah.
kids.
Yeah.
Adopted it
yeah,
in Rwanda. Freaking insane.
So so anyway.
I'm sorry I said the word freaking.
I discovered that's okay.
Keep going.
I discovered that I could do something else. I could do ministry, and my husband and I were really enjoying taking people to Rwanda and raising money for sponsorship. And just there was just really an allure and an emotional high in doing ministry. And I did that at the same time as I was growing my business, and I came to this kind of crossroads of feeling discontent about the accounting work and the drudgery of reviewing documents and especially testifying in court. And just it just really seemed like a downer a lot of days, and I was kind of looking at that and looking at Rwanda and kids. And I really prayed about that, and God challenged me to understand why I had gotten into forensic accounting and why I'm good at it. And so I prayed and I thought about that, and God showed me that he made me to be a truth teller, and I have like this unique kind of gift of speaking the truth, especially in situations where it's not apparent or it's very confusing. And in doing so, it's kind of like putting cool water onto a flame of conflict. and that I'd always been that way in my life, and that he had used that and kind of grown me up into something big professionally in that way. And once I discovered that, I just settled down and realized that I needed to keep doing what I was doing. And he also gave me assurance that there were other people who could do Africa New Life, who could carry that, who could raise money. In fact, there were quite a few people who could do that, and he challenged me and showed me that there's not that many people who do this truth-telling thing in the legal community like I'm doing, and he wanted me to stay and do it full-time, not give it up. And I also realized in that kind of thinking investigation that I need to tell the truth, because even though God made me that way, nobody's perfect, and there's so much pressure to manipulate a story or to my client's favor or whatever, and that I needed to be true to him, faithful to him under that pressure, and tell the truth in what I'm doing. So once I figured that out, now I'm content. Now I get it. And I challenge all of you, if you're good at something, to understand why. You know, why are you good at that? How has God wired you to make you like that?
Got a good word. And, you know, we talk about a dual vocation, create culture, which you are doing, and make disciples. You also really have a heart to see your colleagues come to know Jesus. Am I right?
Yes. I work a lot with attorneys, and I find I just love my clients. The attorneys in Portland are just wonderful people. They're very smart, great people, wonderful to work with. We're really lucky in this city to have such classy group of attorneys. And I walk around, I do prayer walks downtown around the big buildings, and I pray for my clients, the attorneys by name. I take a list of their names with me so I don't forget them. And I just feel such a passion for them, for their souls, for their families. I pray for the growth of their businesses. I'm also involved in a kind of a business Christian networking group. I've been doing it for about 15 years, where we meet for lunch and we invite other professionals and we just tell stories. We have a speaker share about how God has changed their life. And we try not to make it preachy or use Christian words. We just explain what our life is like with God and what it was like before. And there's been so much power over the years in doing that, just in how we've developed relationships around the business community.
And you know, you don't know this, but last hour a dude came up to me who works in the business community downtown, and he said, "Oh my gosh, you have the right people up there. Serena, everybody her in the business community knows her. And the moment I bring up her name, the first thing everybody says is that woman's faith." And he said, "You have a fabulous reputation in the business community. Well done. keep up the good work. Well done." Let's land with my brother from another mother, Robbie Fuller. Okay, stop. No. Robbie and I go way back. We are friends, buddies. Robbie, you are a shoe designer for Adidas. Am I right?
Yes.
And he was. Who said awesome? Where's the shoe? Don't you have a shoe up here somewhere?
Ta-da.
Oh! Look at that behind the back. You made that, well, not made that, but somebody in another continent made that. But but you work for employment around.
A co-worker. Built it together.
You designed that. Nike. Ooh, I'm sorry. Robbie was the head of Adidas basketball, and now you are, you got promoted. What's your job title now?
Yeah, I'm in charge of basically advanced concepts for footwear in the U.S. So anything you see on SportsCenter or you go to Foot Locker in the next couple of years, I either designed it or I set the direction for it, and then another team takes over.
Right. You said it's like concept cars, but for shoes.
Exactly. Right. Like you see D. Rose killing it, the MVP of the league. I did his
us
last...
Us jocks have, non-jocks
no,
have
no,
no
clue
idea
what, I'm talking
what you're talking about.
You know, Dwight Howard,
no.
Josh Smith.
Don't know who Dwight Howard is, don't care. Yeah. If he's not on iTunes, I don't
bless
care.
Bless his heart. Bless his heart.
Bless his sweet little
heart. Bless his
heart. Yeah, he's from the South. Bless his sweet little heart. And
the Christian eraser phrase.
Yeah.
Bless his heart.
Never mind. We need to hang out later and preach right now. What's the story? You make shoes. Like, was that like a random kind of post-college, what am I going to do with my life at 34 deal? Or was that something early on? Like, what's the story?
All right, so grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. When I was in like fifth grade, Michael Jordan opened up a store about two blocks from my house called Flight 23. And at the grand opening, they gave away little keychains with like the Air Revolution, the Jordan 3, when it first came out, not the retro, you know. So we all thought that was awesome. So we went home, started sketching, and basically I'm the one that stuck with it, maybe a little too much. My fifth grade report card says a little less athletic shoe drawing might prove beneficial. Right there. True story. Wrong. Wrong.
Yeah, wrong.
Wrong. We're Facebook buddies. We're cool now. Yeah. So anywho, big into shoes. My brother does like a grandmama commercial. I find out, you know, I email this guy. No, excuse me. I write a letter to this guy to find out what kind of degree I need to get. And he told me an industrial design degree. So if you want to design anything other than a house, you pretty much need to get an industrial design degree. So I went to NC State, got the degree, interned at Converse a couple times, and then graduated in 2000. So don't let the baby face fool you. And came out to Portland, Oregon to work for Adidas. I was here for 1 year, then went to Germany for 3 years. If you don't know, Adidas is a German company.
So. It's actually called Adidas.
Adidas.
Am I right?
Started by Adi Dassler, and then his brother was Rudolf Dassler, and then they split, and Adi did Adi, and Rudolf
we don't
did
care.
Puma.
Keep going.
All right.
Yeah.
So,
oh,
long
really?
Story
Puma. That's interesting.
Short.
Oh, wow. Late 90s, I was into Pumas. Yeah.
It's all good. It's all good. It's cool. So long story short, I'm here, and I got punched in the stomach last week by the Holy Spirit when John Mark started talking about work, and I thought the Spirit was just like, go offer whatever he needs, and of course, 5 seconds later, he comes over and goes, I need you next week to talk.
You were bitter
Funny
because I was talking about designing shoes for Nike last week, and you were not happy with
that. Nike and Keen and whatever.
Whatever. Okay. Shut up. You love what you do, and on a serious note, you're really good at what you do. And where does the gospel come into your work and your job? You travel quite a bit, right? And your relationships. Yeah. How does the gospel come to bear on your job?
Oh, man. I'd say two quick ways. One is in building and creating things. Just like you've mentioned about how like the garden was as it was intended. And so I've built a lot of shoes or products in my career, and quite a few of them have not been as intended. And when they come in, you're like, whoa, that's terrible. And it's like gloomy and just, you know, bitter. And then, but when things come in and they're right. And it's joyous and peaceful and you know, just a calm. It's just as things are intended. So I see Christ in kind of in that area. But probably more important just as important is the being intentional. I just reminded at all times, every single thing you do can be missional, can be intentional, whether it's a trip, 35 trips to Germany to China so far. So I've had like gospel conversations inside of Buddhist temples in China. You can take Bibles if you want. They don't know. At 30,000 feet, 10-hour flight, stuck in coach, and talking to the guy beside me and challenging him on how he's unequally yoked with his girlfriend and what needs to happen there.
You should have that conversation with a bunch of these people when you're done.
Ask her off the horse. Don't date to date. I could go through all of them. I met my wife. She was singing up here, and I invited her to go try out for American Idol. And we did. So everything, everything can be intentional for God's good. And now we have a wonderful family with a 20-month-old. So.
Yeah.
For sure, one person I know that I've been blessed to be a part of them coming to faith. And I look forward to getting being in heaven and seeing a lot of faces that are quite familiar that I didn't know. Maybe I said one word, or I was just at the right place at the right time, or didn't have that drink, or didn't do something that set them towards a path toward faith.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you all for being here. Thank you so much. Your lives are theology in motion, and thank you for that. Let's land with one more text. Turn really fast to 1 Corinthians 3. I don't know how to preach with a shoe on my table. 1 Corinthians 3. I want to read one more text really fast before we wrap up. 1 Corinthians 3. Look down. In light of all that and what's up on stage and the stories we are telling, look at 1 Corinthians 3. Look down at 5. Paul writes to the church in Corinth, "What after all is Apollos? What is Paul? Only servants," meaning Paul's work was serving the church. Work is serving. "Through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God has been making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes all things grow." Notice the garden imagery. He's saying we carry on the work of Adam and Eve in the garden. "The one who plants and the one who waters have one purpose. They will each be rewarded according to their own labor. For we are co-workers in God's service. You are God's field, God's building." Now, so much here we don't have time to get into and allusions back to Genesis. But long story short, notice Paul's language. He writes, "We are co-workers." Now, in the Greek, he's not saying, it's really clear in the Greek, he's not saying Paul and Apollos are co-workers. He's saying Paul and Apollos and God are co-workers. A bunch of versions have, "For we are God's fellow workers," or "We are God's co-workers." Please get the gravity of Paul's words. He's saying you're not employees who work for God as much as you are co-workers with God. He's back to the imagery of partners from Genesis 1 and 2. Let's talk for a second about the difference between partners and employees. What's the difference between partners and employees in one word? Yeah, who said?
Ownership.
You were here last hour. You don't count, Robbie. Yeah, ownership. The difference is ownership. One of my first jobs was junior in high school as a barista at a coffee shop back I'm a bit older than a bunch of you, pre-third wave coffee, before Stumptown. Can you imagine Portland without Stumptown? No Cova, no Barista, no Heart, no Ristretto, none of the good stuff, right? Coffee People was the hip shop back in town. Anybody remember Coffee People? Black Tyrant Milkshake, anybody? No? Yes. Okay, fans. And I worked at Coffee People. And every once in a while, out of the blue, 20, 30, 40, 50 people would all walk in the door at the exact same time. We called it the rush, right? And whenever that would happen, I remember I would work once in a while with the owners or with the partners would come into the store. And whenever that would happen, it was always interesting to notice the difference in tone between the partners and the employees. Because the employees, like myself, were paid like negative $3 back in the 90s. And, you know, when people walk in and the crowd hits, you get annoyed. You know, and people, the employees were always grouchy and complaining and, "Why, people are here." Yes, it's a coffee shop, right? And annoyed, and now I don't get off, and now I get off late, and now for, you know, $5 an hour, I'm working my tail off, and blah, 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 woe is me. And because if you're an employee, it's more work for, you know, the same exact same amount of pay, right? And you get annoyed. But if you're a partner, when that happens, how do you feel? Yeah, you feel on top of the world because you feel ownership. Please get, when it comes to the world, you are God's partners. When you wake up tomorrow morning, you're not just an employee of Adidas designing shoes. You are a partner with God taking the world somewhere. You're not just a mom getting a few kids off to school and making it through the day. You are a human living up to God's first job description. God's calling on you to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, rule over God's beautiful world. You're not just a barista or a bus driver or a grocery store checkout clerk or a doctor or a dentist or a student or an architect or a builder or a bricklayer or a forensic accountant or a scientist. You are a modern day Adam or Eve, and the world is a garden, and God is looking for partners. Let's pray.